I first address the issue, the kind of error related to jury instructions. In this case, the trial court erred by denying Waller's proposed model jury instruction on knowledge of the character of the controlled substance, where the other instructions did not cover the substance of the proposed instruction. The proposed instruction is not duplicative, as the Commonwealth argued at trial, and as I believe the Attorney General's position is. The other instructions did not cover the meaning of knowledge of character, that the defendant had to know that he possessed a controlled substance. And the defendant is entitled to instruction if it is supported by more than a scintilla of the evidence. The jury instructions must leave nothing unsaid which needs to be said, and when reviewing jury instructions, the appellate courts have a duty to see that the law has been clearly stated, and the instruction covers all issues which the evidence fairly raises. To sustain a conviction for possession, the Commonwealth must have proved two types of knowledge, that the defendant knew that he had the drug and that he knew what he had, that he knew that he had a controlled substance.
And the court had refused your instruction, saying that it was already covered by an instruction that had been offered by the Commonwealth.
Yes, the court refused the model instruction on knowledge of character on the basis that it was covered by the model instruction on knowing intentional possession.
And wasn't that in the form of a finding instruction that actually mentioned the knowledge of the nature and character of the substance?
The admitted instruction on knowing intentional possession states only to knowingly intentionally possess a controlled substance means a person is aware of the presence and character of the substance. And then later on in the instruction says that possession may be proved by acts, declarations, or conduct of the defendant from which it may be fairly inferred that he was aware of the presence and character of the substance at the place found, but never defines for the jury what that means. And that knowledge of character is not within common knowledge and has legal definition. And for that reason, Mr. Waller maintains that the trial court erred in not allowing his model instruction on that issue.
Okay.
If I could next address the issue of jury selection. Mr. Waller maintains that the trial judge erred by not timely disclosing that he personally knew a jury on the voir dire panel, creating reasonable doubt as to that juror's impartiality and violating Waller's right to an impartial panel.
Help me understand that one, because it strikes me that even friends of judges could be unbiased.
They could be, and I think the issue in this case is that because it was not disclosed by either the potential juror nor the judge, no one was permitted to question her about their relationship, or the judge about the relationship, for that matter. And the judge, who, when he finally disclosed that he knew her, characterized her as a friend and indicated that he had known her husband since childhood, indicating more than just a casual acquaintanceship with her. And
counsel, what about the fact that there was no objection raised at the time that the court made counsel aware of the problem?
My argument would be that Virginia Code 8.01.384A does allow for review for the first time on appeal when there was no opportunity to object. Waller did not have an opportunity to object in this case because the information was not disclosed until after the peremptory strikes were taken, the jury was impaneled, and the remaining members were allowed to leave.
But at that point, he could have asked for a mistrial.
He could have asked for a mistrial, and his position is that the contemporaneous objection rule, the no opportunity to object exception to that rule, does not require him to have made a motion for a mistrial, because the trial court could not have remedied the error at the time. I guess
could have granted a mistrial.
Yes, but could not have remedied the error as to removing Ms. Hungerford, the juror question at issue, from the panel to make peremptory strikes. And looking at the case law in the Amos case and then in the Maxwell and Roe case, the Supreme Court makes a distinction between when the trial court can still remedy the error. In the Amos case, the Supreme Court held that the plain language of the statute is clear and unqualified. The statute imposes no requirement that when the contemporaneous objection exception applies, the party, if able, must file a post-conviction objection or otherwise bring the objection to the court's attention at a later point in the proceedings. And then
Excuse me, I don't recall in reading through the record, was there an alternate or were there alternates seated?
There were no alternates. It was a one-day
I didn't think
jury.
There were, but I wanted to be sure.
And that certainly raises an interesting point. Had there been alternates, I think it could still have been remedied at that point. But because there were not, it could not have been. In the Maxwell and Roe case, the Supreme Court makes the distinction in Maxwell where the jury questions that the trial court answered in the absence of defense counsel, the court points out that the jury was still deliberating. Thus, it still could have been remedied in theory with perhaps additional instructions to the jury. And in Roe, the objection was made during closing argument, but the basis for it was not stated until after the closing was over, and therefore could not be remedied at the time it was made.
Counsel, assuming that we were to find that there was error in this situation, does a harmless error analysis apply?
It does not. I believe in the David case, 1997, that I cited in my opening brief, the court held that it is prejudicial error, not harmless error, for the trial court to fail to remove an impartial juror from the panel, even where the defendant uses a peremptory strike on them and they are not seated on the jury. And so for that reason, I would submit that the error is not harmless. And unless the court has other questions, I'll save my additional time for rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you. Ms. Martin?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Kathleen Martin for the Commonwealth. We ask that this conviction be affirmed because there was no error committed by the trial court in any of the four issues that have been raised. With regard to the first issue about the juror problem, the issue did not arise during voir dire because the issue arose when the judge said at the lunch break, who struck Ms. Hungerford? She was a friend of mine. I know her husband. At that point, the defendant certainly had the opportunity to move for mistrial or to make some sort of objection, but the defendant said nothing, and neither did the prosecutor. They all went to lunch. They came back. They had the trial. And certainly, if the defendant had been acquitted, he would not have raised this issue at all. It wouldn't have come up. But by sort of waiting, he gets to find out what the verdict's going to be. Then he comes back and says under the statute, well, I didn't have an opportunity to object. And so he gets really a second chance at a new trial if the court finds that were error. The other thing about both Amos and 8.01 384A is that it's very clear that they apply when the party had no opportunity to make an objection when the issue arises. In Amos, the defendant was a witness. She didn't have an attorney. She was immediately taken to jail. She had no opportunity to say anything. And in Maxwell, the attorney was not in the courtroom when the judge answered the juror's question. So again, there was no opportunity. And when the defense attorney did find out about that, they moved to set aside the verdict. So they did do something to raise the issue. They simply did not wait until they got to appeal and said, oh, well, I'll just raise this. Doesn't matter. I didn't do it before. So certainly, we would say that they waived their opportunity to object, and that's procedurally barred. But if the court were to get to the merits, keep in mind that no one was asked on this panel if they knew any judges or if they knew this judge. They were asked about Commonwealth's attorney. They were asked about defense counsel. They were asked generally, are you an attorney? Do you have any family or friends who are an attorney? And three people responded that they knew attorneys. They all said it would not make any difference in their handling of the case. They could be fair and impartial. They were not asked to identify the attorneys they knew by name. And so only the one juror that said she knew a civil attorney was the one that the defendant struck. He did not strike the other two people who said they also knew attorneys, and also a juror who had been represented by the Commonwealth's attorney before he was Commonwealth's attorney was not struck either. So certainly the fact, there's no cases that say that the fact that you know a judge is a per se disqualification for a juror. In the Wise case, the Commonwealth attorney and one of the jurors played golf, and the court said, well, social relationships in and of themselves are not enough to disqualify. In the Mayfield case, the juror her nephew and daughter of her cousin were witnesses in the case. And again, that was not enough to disqualify that juror. So because there'd be no reason to strike this juror for cause, even if that had been known, certainly there's just no merit to this argument, and that would not be a reason to reverse this conviction. Excuse me. Moving on to the jury instruction issue, the commentary for the model jury instructions for both of these instructions say that you do not have to give them at the same time. That if you give one, it's not necessary to give the other one. And the one that the defendant wanted, where he said that the defendant had to be aware the substance was cocaine, came out of the Young case, where there in that case there were some pills of who, you know, what they were was undetermined. And so if that's the case, then you have to have something that says that the defendant actually knows this is a controlled substance. But in this case, the substance itself was cocaine. The defendant argued to the jury that the Commonwealth had to prove the defendant knew it was cocaine, so certainly he was not prejudiced in any way in making that argument by the instructions that were given. And since, you know, even though his construction might have been more concisely stated, the other instruction that the court gave did cover all the issues. It adequately addressed what the jury had to find, and so certainly there was no error in the trial court in not giving a duplicate instruction. In regard to the other two issues, there was no abuse in admitting the certificate of analysis and letting the expert testify. The defendant had objected on chain of custody grounds, but we had the police officer who collected it. We had the police officer who was responsible for taking the evidence from this locker to the lab, and then the lab testified. Because of some glitch, the drugs themselves were not admitted. But the police and the lab personnel testified about their procedure. It is presumed that that was done correctly. All of the necessary links were established to show the handling of the evidence from the time it was collected to the time that it was tested. There were 8 bags tested. The lab testified to that. The officers testified to that. The fact that it might have been a little difference in color could have been the lighting conditions, as the trial court noted. It might have been that these two people just didn't really know how to identify colors. And so certainly any gaps in this chain of custody go to the weight of the evidence. They do not go to the admissibility. So the trial court did not err in allowing the evidence to come in. And finally, with regard to sufficiency, we look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth. The defendant had this cigarette pack with the cocaine in his pocket. He was very nervous. The officer said much more nervous than would be expected for a simple possession of marijuana. He said he had nothing in his pocket, but the police found the cigarette pack there, so certainly that's the inference that he was lying to conceal his guilt. He asked, can I have my cigarettes? The police officer gave him one, but there's no evidence that he actually smoked it or even asked for a light, and his hands were handcuffed at that particular point. So again, the inference is that he wanted the cigarette pack back before the police had an opportunity to look more closely at it. And so certainly, if you look at all of those factors, the evidence does support the finding that he knew he had cocaine, and for all of those reasons, we would ask that this conviction be affirmed.
Thank you. Ms. Dalton, your rebuttal time, and I'm curious, how do we get around the commentary with those two jury instructions saying it's an either-or proposition, no need to give both?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that the commentary is in error and is not in keeping with the Young Sierra Christian decisions more recently, but that the jury instruction or commentary or practice advice given in the jury instructions is not law. It's just simply not law. And what the law actually states in Young, the 2008 case, is that to establish possession, the Commonwealth must not only show actual or constructive possession, but must also establish the defendant intentionally and consciously possessed the drug with knowledge of its nature and character further holding that knowledge of character is an essential element of the crime of possession. And to my knowledge, Young has only been limited by two cases in 2012 of Sierra and Christian. And Sierra stated that the plain language of Virginia Code 18.2250 requires a defendant to know that the substance he possesses is in fact a controlled substance, but does not require him to know precisely what that controlled substance is. And although originally the proposed instruction did mention specifically cocaine, defense counsel suggested the court propose modifying it to list controlled substance in the first and last sentences, and the Commonwealth still objected to that amended proposed instruction. In the Christian case, limits Young only to the extent that where the illegal nature of the substance is apparent, and in Christian it was crack cocaine, whereas in this case it was powder cocaine, that that circumstance would support a finding the defendant's knowledge of the contraband he possesses. But in this case, as argued, in the argument for the proposed instruction, there are many substances that have the same appearance as powder cocaine. And so neither the Sierra nor Christian opinions limit the knowledge of character element of this particular case. It's specifically because there were no statements by Mr. Waller identifying the drug that he had. As to the jury selection issue, I would disagree with the Commonwealth as to when the issue arose. I do not feel that the issue arose when the trial court disclosed it. That's when it came to everyone's knowledge or awareness, but rather when the trial court allowed Ms. Hungerford to be selected to remain on the panel without comment and for her to remain on the panel when peremptory strikes were taken.
Counsel, how do you respond to the Commonwealth's point that social relationships are not enough to disqualify a juror, and the defense attorney was at liberty to ask the venire if anybody had a relationship with the judge and didn't do that?
Well, and I certainly agree that they had the opportunity to ask that question and did not, but did ask if she knew any judges, to which she replied, one, a civil attorney.
You mean any attorneys?
Any attorneys, yes, I'm sorry. She said, yes, a civil attorney, without specifying that it was Judge Cavito. Presumably she was not referring to Judge Cavito, and Judge Cavito is also a lawyer in addition to being a judge. And the cases that the Commonwealth cites as to the proposition that a relationship with the judge is not per se disqualification, in all of those cases, the relationship was disclosed, and Commonwealth and defense counsel had the opportunity to question the juror about the nature of the relationship. It is entirely possible, had Ms. Hungerford been questioned as to the nature of her relationship with the judge, that she still would have been allowed to remain on the panel. But the fact that she did not disclose it, I think, is additionally problematic. But the law states that all doubts about the fitness of a juror to serve must be resolved in favor of the accused. And doubt as to the fitness or impartiality or bias of a juror requires the potential juror's exclusion. One additional point, briefly, is that in Maxwell and Roe, although certainly the Attorney General's point that a motion to set aside is prudent, Maxwell and Roe is very specific that a motion to set aside is not required.
Thank you very much. We will come down and greet counsel and thereafter take up the case of